on this week's program, a conversation with Charles Dutoit, the incoming chief conductor and artistic director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Susan Lewis explores The River of Gold, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. And Jason Pfeiffer takes us to Ensemble at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
When Christoph Eschenbach closes the door of his dressing room for the last time as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra sometime next year, Kimmel Center workers will change the sign to read Chief Conductor and Artistic Advisor. The new regular occupant of the plushest room backstage will be Charles Dutoit. He'll lead the orchestra and do almost everything a music director would do, but for four seasons only. In 2012, an as yet unknown conductor will hang his tails in the music director's wardrobe. Charles Dutoit has had a long relationship with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Since his first appearance on the podium at the Mann Center in 1980, he's been back most years to guest conduct. He's been principal conductor of the orchestra's summer residence at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center since 1990. He also directed the Mann Center program from 1990 to 1999. Dutoit was music director of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra from 1977 to 2002, principal conductor of the Orchestra Nationale de France from 1991 to 2001, and principal conductor of Tokyo's NHK Symphony from 1996 to 2003, meaning that for a number of years in the late 90s, Dutoit was in charge of three major orchestras at the same time. I spoke with Charles Dutoit earlier this year, shortly after his appointment to his new position had been announced. First of all, congratulations on the new appointment.
Thank you very much. It's very nice.
Give us some idea of the discussions that took place leading up to this.
Well, I mean, it's, what can I say? The orchestra needs to have somebody, you know, here in Philadelphia for a couple of seasons. Now, you know, for the last 5 years, I've been invited to become a music director here and there, several orchestras in this country and also in Europe, but you know, I didn't want to take a new position because I'd been 40 years already conducting and being music director from 1963 when I got my first position to 2002. So it's actually, for 39 years. So I thought it was enough for a while. And then, you see, I wanted to use some time free for other activities such as traveling in some countries which I cannot visit professionally and so on. So when the orchestra asked me to come, you see, I could not take a position as a music director anyway because I'm too old for that, you see. When I will start here, I will be 71. And, you know, when if you are really a responsible person, music director, you have to think of at least 10 years of activity with an orchestra. So, you know, I don't want to. I want to have, as I always say these days, because this question has been asked several times, I want to have an early retirement at 76, you see. And that's why I think I'm very happy with this solution, and the orchestra seems to be happy too. And they have 5 years now to find somebody who will take over the orchestra in 76 at my age, in 2012.
You've had a more than quarter century relationship with this orchestra. Can you tell us how that's evolved since the early 1980s when you first conducted here?
Oh, it's a long relationship, which started in the 50s in Geneva when I heard the orchestra for the first time with Ormandy. I think it was their first trip to Europe, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, we had never heard an orchestra like this ever. So we were so impressed. And as I told the orchestra when I came back the other day, I always kept that in my mind as the reference for the high standards of an orchestra, what an orchestra can achieve. Now, when I started here in 1980, you know, in the summer of 1980, for a full week at the Mann Music Center, I found that incredible orchestra, which was reacting to any sensitive gesture, you know, when you lift your finger, you could change the color and so on. And I always loved to play with them. They have that kind of sound that is very unique. And that they tend, you know, they had a hard time to keep completely because of the changes, you know. It's normal when the old members of the orchestra are retired And then you see the young people come and they are so fantastic. But they have to be led into some kind of tradition, you see. But it's very easy to show them how to play, you see. That sound can come back very quickly. So, you know, I've done so many concerts with them all over the years, a huge repertoire with different styles. And we have made tours, went to Florida, went to New York many times and so on. It's like I'm at home here, you know. I see my friends, the old friends, and we have a very nice private relationship as well. So it's all good.
You talk about this Philadelphia sound. Can you describe that for us?
Well, you know it, don't you? The sound of that depth in the string, that dark sound, it's like a cognac, you know, and brandy, you know, brandy sort of. There are some sound like more like a Bordeaux wine, more or like a Burgundy, but this one is a cognac. You understand what I mean? It's a very special old pale. That is that kind of sound, and that has been built over the years by the tradition of Stokowski and Ormandy and the Academy of Music and the kind of repertoire that they have played mostly. You know, things such as the music of Rachmaninoff, Shostakovich, of Sibelius, and so on. This kind of, you know, dark, beautiful, dark sound in the strings. And they have also, of course, these fantastic players, the solo players, woodwinds and brass, you know. So I think it's normal that today orchestras tend to play a lot of different things. Before, it was more focused on a certain repertoire, which was very important to build the general sound and the image of the orchestra. But now today, many orchestras have to play so many different things and adjust to different styles and so on. So the tendency is to become a little more flexible in a way, but also a little more international, which I don't like. You see, I like the old fashioned way of having these orchestras with their specific personality and try to keep them. Now, the recording business have been evolved so much, and they tend to make everything sound the same, you know. And I don't like that. I like to go to be here and get the Philadelphia sound and personality and go to Boston, and it's a different sound. Or go to London or to Chicago, you see. I like that, you see, personally. But, of course, the sound of an orchestra doesn't mean everything, because it's the sound of the music that you play, you see. Of course, we cannot have the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra when you play Haydn Symphony, you understand? We have to adjust to the style of the music that we play. But basically, you know, the personality of an orchestra includes that kind of sound, you see.
When you're conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra, is it necessary for you to moderate your conducting style, or do the players themselves know how to achieve this Philadelphia sound? How much does it depend on the conductor, do you think?
No. I think you have to help to produce it. Or sometimes you have to remind them, ask them, hey, where is this famous Philadelphia sound? And the one who know what it was, they can produce it. But there are some younger players, you know, they have got to be let in, as I told you before. They have to be told and show how to get in. But, I mean, this week was rather spectacular, how it came back very quickly, you see.
In rehearsal, what's your approach to dealing with the musicians? Are you quiet, contemplative, giving small instructions, or are you passionate and very avid on the podium?
Well, it depends on what you are doing and the result you get. You see, I have no preconceived idea about organizing a rehearsal. You see, I arrive and usually I like to, wherever I am, to play at least 20 minutes, 25 minutes, sometimes a full symphony. I would start the first rehearsal to play a full symphony, and then, you know, things I know, for instance, because I know this orchestra so well, I know when something doesn't go well the first time, I don't even have to stop, because I know the second time it will be corrected just by themselves, you see. It's just a question of having a second experience of this passage. But sometimes then you, if it doesn't come, whatever orchestra it is, you have to start working and rehearsing, and there is a rehearsal technique. Depending on the problem, you know, it's a long chapter. You know, it's hard to answer such a question in a minute. because it depends on what kind of specific problem you have to face, whether it's a problem of intonation, of balance, of ensemble, of rhythm, you know, and each specific problem must be dealt separately. And usually, you know, an orchestra like the Philadelphia Orchestra, things go well very fast because they are, you know, the equipment is sensational, you see what I mean.
Whether you've been called music director or chief conductor, you will in those 4 years contribute to the history of the Philadelphia Orchestra. What will your programming philosophy be? Will it be a heavy emphasis on standard repertoire? Are you looking forward to commissioning new work? Are you looking forward to bringing perhaps less performed work to the Philadelphia audience?
Well, I think you gave the answer. It's exactly that, you see. You know, our responsibility, whatever position or title you have, is the same. We have to – there is a program of commission pieces to commission composers. And, you know, of course, we have to have the standard repertoire because the public likes it. And we also have – I also keep in mind the kind of music I need to keep that sound that we are talking about. And also, obviously, you know, the curiosity of bringing new things. So, I mean, you answered yourself.
Maestro, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to you.
Charles Dutoit. He becomes chief conductor and artistic advisor of the Philadelphia Orchestra in September 2008.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Gold is a timeless treasure craved by civilizations throughout recorded history. Shiny and brilliant, malleable and strong, linked to the gods themselves, gold has long been known to be one of Earth's few indestructible elements. Its luster and its immortality has lent it a spiritual significance in many cultures, while in modern society its allure continues. An exhibition at Penn's University Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology displays artifacts from a Panamanian civilization that existed around 700 AD, evidence of which was revealed only in the 20th century. River of Gold tells the story not only of this ancient civilization, but of the work involved in bringing its discovery to light in 1940. WRTI's Susan Lewis has more.
It's easy to picture. Children playing along a tropical riverbank, some running, some squatting and digging with sticks in the sloping dirt and grasses that grow at the side of the water. With the sun blazing overhead, what look like small stones at their feet glint and glimmer, begging to be picked up and played with, demanding to be discovered. This was how the story started about the River of Gold, or the Rio Grande de Clocle, a mountain river that runs from the Sierra across the coastal plains of Panama, emptying into the Bay of Parida.
That particular river, back in the early 1900s, overflowed its banks, cut a new course for itself, and in so doing exposed a major burial of one of these ancient Panamanian chiefs.
Pamela Jardine is curator of the University of Pennsylvania Museum's River of Gold exhibition. When we enter the gallery, the deep purplish walls contain us, cave-like. As we look across the darkened, windowless space, focused beams of light glow from above or below onto small groups of gleaming treasures laid out in glass cases by exhibit designer Jack Murray.
I wanted to provide something that was intimate, and yet I wanted the gold and the pottery as well, to sparkle.
Most of the objects are gold. Intricate cast pendants of composite animals, hammered breastplates, armbands, necklaces, ear rods, and nose rings. There is also pottery, some whole vessels, as well as bowls that have been put together from pieces. The exhibition tells several stories. One, of an ancient civilization, the existence of which was missed for centuries, overlooked by explorers, even the 16th century Spanish conquerors, who knew, more or less, what they were looking for.
The Spaniards knew that these Indians buried their powerful chiefs with all their gold on their chests when they died. So they had very systematically looked for these giant burials. But this one had been overlooked because it's in a pasture that's now a cattle field, and there are no markers. There's nothing to indicate that there was a cemetery there.
Another story is of the river that finally washed over and exposed the treasures. First came the tiny gold beads, then larger objects began to appear.
Some of the gold pendants and things. And so those pieces were sold in the art market, and they ended up in Panama City. And the Panamanian exposition was there in 1915, which was when the Panama Canal opened, and word got out to the archaeologists in the United States.
The cattle field alongside the river, about 100 miles west of Panama City, became known as Sitio Cante, because by the early 20th century, the Cante family owned the land and the mineral rights beneath it. Harvard University excavated in the 1930s, then recommended the University of Pennsylvania for further exploration. In 1940, archaeologist J. Alden Mason put together a crew to see what they could find in the three-month period before the rainy season. They struck gold, literally, in a spot designated as Burial 11. Now a retired Foreign Service officer, Mason's then 17-year-old son was on the dig. John Mason remembers that his father, concerned about security with so much gold lying around, came up with a solution. He asked John to go and sleep in the large grave that was being excavated.
My dad said, "So what I'd like you to do, Johnny, would be to get your cot and take it down and set it up in the pit beside the gold and just spend the night there so we have somebody there to keep an eye on it." So I, when it was sleepy time, went down and stretched out on the cot, and it was a lovely night. I remember it as a full moon, but my memory may gild it a little bit. Gild is a good term here because the moon was shining down brilliantly on this mass of gold. To see that whole glittering mass in the moonlight was indeed quite a moment, and I've never forgotten it.
With all this gold, the Conti family had the same deal with Penn as it had had with Harvard. Penn could take what it collected back home, provided it paid the family half the value, and turned over any duplicate objects found. Penn returned to Philadelphia with thousands of objects, a number of which have been displayed over the years. Handling gold safely might not seem like a problem, but Penn Museum's conservator for loans and traveling exhibits, Lynn Grant, says that looks can be deceiving.
This material is actually a gold alloy that's been treated to make the surface gold rich. And the same treatment that they did to do this, which was very sophisticated given their level of culture, makes it very brittle. So normally with some of these big plaques that we have, if you place stress on it and it was pure gold, it would just crumple like a piece of paper. These ones, if you put that kind of stress on them, they'd be more likely to crunch like a potato chip.
The sophistication of the creation of a gold alloy, the intricate gold-making techniques, and the sheer amount of gold worn by the leader tells us how the culture valued this precious metal, still revered today, says curator Pamela Jardine.
And how these chiefs, when they wore it, that actually was taking them into a position of supernatural authority as well as political authority on earth. They were tied to gold and the sun and celestial power and supernatural power. That's some people's theory as to why they were bedecked in gold.
Much of what was known about these pre-Columbian people came from the accounts of the 16th century Spaniards, who wrote of the mass burials of village chiefs and their wives and servants, who were killed to accompany the chiefs into the afterlife. The Penn excavation, done scientifically, meticulously recorded the location of every find. This exhibition lays out the objects from Burial 11 in the order in which they were discovered. Exhibit designer Jack Murray says there were three layers of graves, each with its own status.
The first case will be from level one, and then the next group of cases is from the middle burial, which was the richest burial with the number of individuals in that grave, and then the third burial, which was at the bottom of the pit that they dug, was apparently just chuck-filled with all this pottery.
Most of the pottery was in pieces, believed to be ceremonially broken to line the walls of the grave. A few have been reassembled and give a glimpse of the iconography used. More clues to the culture are in the gold objects, such as the now famous small golden jaguar pendant, living right now in a case all to himself.
It was found on the chief's chest, and that's an emerald in his back, and that probably came from Colombia or Ecuador because Panama didn't have emeralds, so it shows that they were into long-distance trade.
He's called a jaguar, but look closely and you'll see the composite imagery used in so many of these pieces.
He's got a jaguar body and legs, but his feet become reptile claws, and he's got these strange things that come out of his mouth. He has the eyes of a reptile. His nose is a nose leaf. And then if you look in the back of him, you see the wheels. They're like cogged wheels on the back of his tail and a funny little dangler.
Curator Jardine says no one's figured out what that little dangler is, yet. And so the mysteries and the stories continue, of an ancient civilization with a reverence for gold, of the explorations of a still curious contemporary culture, and of the river whose rushing waters connected the two.
WRTI's Susan Lewis, River of Gold at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, runs through December 16th. An ongoing exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia is called Ensemble. This is an unusual exhibition, even for a contemporary art venue prone to experimentation. It's a sound art show made up of sculptures and installations selected primarily for the sounds they make, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports.
The Ensemble exhibit inaugurates the guest curator program at the Institute of Contemporary Art. As opposed to assembling new exhibits through the more traditional route with an in-house curator, the new initiative is designed to bring outside viewpoints to the museum. As ICA director Claudia Gould and her staff discussed who to invite, she says they considered art historians, freelance curators.
And then we said, why not an artist? We're an institution that focuses very artist-centric. So why not go to the source of what we show here and what we support?
Gould says because artists are mainly interested in showing their own work, the ICA looked for a creator who was generous, who could go outside him or herself to put together a group of works from others. In their view, Christian Marclay fit the bill. A composer of experimental music, a DJ, and a visual artist, Marclay had never curated a visual exhibition before, but he proposed the idea of a show based on live, non-amplified sound. It was the sort of novel approach that Claudia Gould had in mind.
None of us would have thought of this. And so that's the idea, is to bring something here that we as curators would never be able to think of or conjure up, is to sort of expand our own horizons and also the audience of Philadelphia to different kinds of things.
In putting together the Ensemble exhibition, Christian Marclay didn't really see his role to be that of a curator. Instead, he describes himself as a collage artist.
I've always been interested in this idea of collecting things and using things that exist out there in the world. I'm not, you know, even though I make sculptures, I don't carve them out of stone or cast them in bronze. I'm more interested in what's around me. And this idea of putting this show together actually came out of probably that kind of practice where I'm more of a collagist, finding things, putting them together, finding interesting juxtapositions and relationship between objects. And in this case, I was more interested in the sound that these works could produce and how they would coexist in the same space.
Featuring the work of about 30 artists, Ensemble spans the spectrum of sounds, from an assortment of music boxes to bells, hundreds of shells hanging on string, to a ball rolling downward on a series of metal tracks. One exhibit piece, appropriately titled The Alarming Trash Can, is an innocent-looking, mundane metal garbage bin. But lift the can cover, and you'll be in for a jolt. Angela White's exhibit piece, called Three Turntables and Michael Jackson, consisting of three record players that cause shards of hanging ceramic pieces to collide with one another, is situated close to the alarming trash can, which doesn't bother White.
When I'm working in my studio, I'm like right behind the fire station, so I hear this like, like all of a sudden I'm working and listening, and then there's this huge fire truck that's like rolling down the street and making these huge sounds. So I'm like, I hear live fire engine sounds with my piece, so it's kind of interesting being right next to the piece that sounds like a big siren. Yeah, I feel at home.
White says just as sounds constantly overlap in everyday life, it seems natural that these exhibit sounds would coexist as well. And this is indeed one of the core ideas of this exhibition. All the different sounds of the sculptures and installations should overlap and mix, Christian Mark Lay says his DJ experiences informed his work of piecing together this new ICA show.
I've been DJing since the late 70s, so that's sort of how I traditionally make sounds. Why do I select some records to mix together? Because I feel like they can work together and create something else. It is very much about finding sounds and putting them together to create new compositions.
Creating artistic compositions with sound is, of course, nothing new. But just as there are many different perspectives as to what constitutes visual art, the question of when sound becomes art is also difficult to define. Yet Christian Mark Lay doesn't dwell too long on such heady matters and is more interested in creating greater awareness of the sounds around us.
How suddenly if you create an environment in which you're forced to listen, then your attention is going to be very different than if you're just walking down the street thinking I'm late for this meeting. In the art context of a museum or a gallery, one tends to want to isolate that sound and give it this kind of perfect frame where nothing is going to come and disturb it. And to me, that's what I'm reacting against. I don't want that artificial space. I'm interested in life, and art should be life, and it is life.
With motion sensors that activate various exhibit pieces and other works meant to produce sound at the touch of a visitor, Christian Mark Lay says the pieces that fill the gallery space will continually relate in new ways.
Hopefully, you know, every time you walk through the space, you'll hear different connections, different sounds interacting together, and no two visits should be the same.
To underline this dynamic of the exhibit, Mark Lay has invited musicians and performers to come throughout the duration of the show to take part in the exhibition, presenting their work and reacting to the sounds they hear from the sculptures and installations. The performances and exhibit pieces will be recorded and eventually released on CD.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Ensemble is at the Institute of Contemporary Art at 36th and Sampson Streets in Philadelphia through December 16th. That's our show. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.